Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Tom Hartman. He is a syndicated talk show host on over 100 radio stations, as well as XM Sirius Satellite Radio, and he's on Free Speech TV. He's the author of 18 books, the latest of which is Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and How You Can Fight Back. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. How are you?
Good. It's great to have you on the air.
Thank you.
So we've all heard about the Supreme Court decision from last January in which corporations were officially recognized as people, but questions about corporate personhood and the relationships between people and corporations and so on go way back to colonial times. And so I was wondering if we could maybe start in the 1770s. You write about the circumstances that led to the Boston Tea Party, which was not only about taxation without representation, which everybody learns in fourth grade history, but also just as much a fight between small businesses and a multinational corporation. What was going on?
Well, the thing that most people think they know that they don't know is that the Tea Act of 1773, which is what provoked the Boston Tea Party, was not a tax hike. It was a tax cut. It was a massive tax cut, in fact, so much so that the British East India Company qualified for what would, in today's dollars, be a multi-billion-dollar tax refund from the British government on tea that they already had in inventory. And that allowed them to drop the price on tea at the wholesale level so low that they were able to, or would be able to, put out of business the hundreds of small American wholesalers, who the British East India Company referred to as smugglers, put them out of business, and also make sure that their brand of tea, and thus lock up the market and control the price, was the only one that was sold in the tens of thousands of little tea shops up and down the East Coast, because this was back, you know, what Starbucks is to America today, tea was in 1773. And, you know, tea and bars were basically, tea houses and bars were basically the major meeting places. So when the British government, in response to lobbying from the East India Company, lowered the tax on tea with the Tea Act of 1773, the colonists, seeing this as an attempt to take over the tea market by the world's largest transnational corporation, revolted and destroyed what would be, in today's dollars, $1 million worth of property of that corporation. England then responded the next year with the Boston Ports Act of 1774, which said that if Boston didn't pay back $1 million to the British East India Tea Company for the tea, that they were going to blockade the harbor. The Bostonians said, "To hell with that. We don't care." And that, you know, led right straight into the American Revolution.
How did the Tea Party and everything that it represented, this alliance between government and large corporations against the people and all of that, how did that influence the thinking of our founding fathers in the way the Constitution was written?
Well, they were very worried about corporate influence, and particularly large transnational corporate influence. They wanted to make sure that on these shores there was never a repeat of something like the East India Company, a large corporation, a corporation so large and powerful that it effectively became the tail that wagged the dog of the British Parliament. And so there were debates, you can find them in the Constitutional Convention notes of James Madison, about whether to regulate corporations. Thomas Jefferson, in a series of letters with Madison that are fairly easy to find online, in 1787, when the first draft of the Constitution was written, demanded that there be a Bill of Rights attached to it which banned monopolies in commerce, explicitly banning commercial monopolies. But the founders felt that the best way to deal with big companies like this was to make sure that they were regulated by the state so that there would be local control and that they couldn't get any larger than an individual state, or if they did, it could be regulated under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. So the Constitution doesn't contain the word corporation. And from 1787, when the Constitution was put forward, 1789 when it was ratified, from then until the 1880s or 1890s, in every state in the Union, which is where the corporate laws existed, It was illegal for a corporation to exist for more than 40 years. They had to be subject to the equivalent of probate because they didn't want corporations to be vessels for multi-generational wealth accumulation. It was illegal for corporations to own stock in other corporations. It was illegal for a corporation to do more than one thing, whatever that one thing was that it was incorporated for. The stockholders and the officers of the corporation were not shielded from liability if the corporation engaged in criminal act. And there are a variety of other protections, most of which got blown up in the late part of the 19th century.
It's amazing to hear that list and to read that list in your book. Were these restrictions really enforced?
Oh, vigorously. At the time of the Civil War, the enforcement of them began to diminish after the Civil War, which is when the railroads rose up and basically bought off, corrupted, bribed the Supreme Court and a lot of state legislators all around the country. But before the Civil War, on average, about 2,000 corporations or companies a year nationwide were given the corporate death penalty, which is where they're ordered to dissolve, sell off all their assets, and basically shut down. It was a fairly routine thing. Every Secretary of State in every state in the Union every year had to examine the books of every corporation, and they were required to be open, by the way, and determine if the company was operating in the public interest. If it was not operating in the public interest, regardless of what it was doing, then it got shut down.
Do you know any examples of companies that got shut down? Just out of curiosity, like what kinds of companies were deemed not to be in the public interest?
Well, the ones that were the principal targets of it in the early 1800s to the early 19th century tended to be wholesale companies, and ones that were the early precursors to the trusts that came in the late part of the 19th century, where a company would be formed and it would buy wheat from dozens of farmers and then take it out in the wholesale market, and when they began trying to fix prices by controlling markets, then the states would step in and shut them down. And this was done in wheat, it was done with copper, it was done with tin. All of this was real frequent. And in fact, this being done with oil in the 1880s was what caused the state of Ohio to tell John Rockefeller, who had the Standard Oil Trust, and he was collaborating and had actually bought some small railroads, was collaborating with them, trucking companies he owned. His Standard Oil Trust went way beyond oil so that he could keep his competitors locked out, so that his competitors couldn't even get their oil to market. And the state of Ohio told him that's illegal and that they were going to shut him down. And that's when the charter mongering era began, what is referred to as the late 1880s, 1890s. John Rockefeller said, okay, Ohio's going to kick me out. What state will change their corporate laws to allow what I'm doing to be legal? And that began a competition among the states to reduce the standards. And ultimately, New Jersey won for Rockefeller. But Delaware has the lowest standards of all the states right now, which is why more than half of all the companies on the New York Stock Exchange are Delaware corporations. Anybody can start a corporation in Delaware. It can live forever. Its purpose for incorporation could be a single sentence. This corporation is incorporated to do anything that's legal in the state of Delaware, and et cetera.
The late 1800s, after the Civil War, was a time of real change around all this stuff. Let's talk about the railroad industry. They were on a tremendous quest for power. What did they do? What did they accomplish?
Well, what happened was during the Civil War, the railroads really began in the United States in the 1830s, the late 1830s, and through the 1840s and 1850s started growing. But when the Civil War happened, Abraham Lincoln needed to get war material around the country, and so he started pouring what in today's dollars would be hundreds of billions of dollars into the railroads, giving them millions of acres of free land, huge financial subsidies, on and on it went. And what came out of this, particularly after his assassination, was that these railroad companies started forming trusts, started buying each other up, and we ended up as we went into the 1880s, with basically five giant railroad companies. And Samuel Huntington ran one, Jay Gould ran another. I don't remember all the other names. Those names are fairly famous, or at least they were for a long time in American history. And these railroads were the Microsofts of their day. I mean, they were the largest corporations that the country had ever seen, and their CEOs and owners were wealthy beyond imagination. And they very much chafed at control by state, local, or even federal government. And so in California, a series of tax cases came up. They were referred to as the California tax cases of the 1880s, where the corporations were saying that because the 14th Amendment had just been passed, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which freed the slaves, were passed in 1874, and the 14th Amendment says all persons shall have equal protection under the law, or no person shall be denied equal protection under the law. And corporations had historically, going back to 6th century British law, been referred to as artificial persons. You had to have both artificial and natural persons. Natural persons are you and me. Artificial persons are corporations, governments, and churches. And they had to have some sort of status as a person so they can own land or sue or be sued or pay taxes. That because that amendment didn't say natural person, it just simply said person, that that meant that corporations had rights under the Constitution and under the Bill of Rights the same as human beings. And the first four or five of these that made their way to the Supreme Court just got laughed at and thrown out. And finally, in 1886, in the Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad case, that one also got thrown out, but that's not what the clerk of the court wrote about it. And that's when history in America really changed.
We're talking to Tom Hartman about his new book, Unequal Protection. So this is something to just stay with for a moment. The 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which basically any school child knows is about giving former slaves full rights of citizenship, the idea that that should be used to give corporations rights of essentially citizenship or rights to be seen as people seems almost laughable. What actually happened in this 1886 decision?
Yeah, the assertion, in fact, Delphin Dulmas, the fellow who argued this case before the Supreme Court on behalf of Santa Clara County, called it ludicrous in the extreme. The railroad was saying that because Santa Clara County and Santa Ana County were charging them two different tax rates, that that was unequal protection under the law. That was the same as saying in a cafeteria that we'll serve white people but we won't serve black people, and that they were the victims of discrimination. And the court did not rule on that at all. But in the headnote of the ruling, which is a commentary written by the clerk of the court that has no legal authority or power, but is sort of like cliff notes for the ruling, in the headnote of that ruling, the clerk of the court, a man by the name of John Chandler Bancroft Davis, wrote, quoting from a conversation that was had in the court, wrote that corporations are persons under the 14th Amendment and therefore entitled to equal protection under the law. Even though that had no legal standing, it has been quoted for over a century by the Supreme Court itself, most recently in Citizens United versus FEC, and perhaps most famously in Boston versus Bilotti, when Rehnquist, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, in a dissent said, you know, back in 1886, this court, without the benefit of public opinion, decided that corporations have the rights of persons, and he was wrong. He hadn't read the case. He had only read the headnote. So when I was writing the book, I was operating on the assumption that the headnote was right, because that's what all the history books say, that corporations were given personhood in 1886 by the Supreme Court. And when I went back and actually read the case, I discovered that that was not the case. It was only in the headnote. And so then I went in to find out who wrote this headnote, and it turned out that John Chandler Bancroft Davis had formerly been the president of the New York and Newburgh Railroad, and that he was being paid off by the railroads, as was Stephen Jay Field, who was on the court, along with two other Supreme Court justices. They were all being bribed very heavily by the railroad corporations of that day to come up with these kind of decisions.
So basically, the precedent upon which over a century of corporate law is based on a mistake?
It's a lie. It's not a mistake.
Yeah, right.
It is. Yeah.
So let's go forward a little bit. You then describe the rise of the use of corporate campaign contributions to increase corporate power. When did that really start in earnest?
Well, the railroads began aggressively supporting candidates in the 1880s and 1890s. I mean, this is when the real corporate corruption of America happened. Prior to the Civil War, there really weren't any large national companies. There were some local, you know, prosperous people, but there wasn't this uber class of corporate wealth. And the corruption was so bad, for example, in the Ulysses S. Grant administration, the Republican president in the 1870s, that the famous Civil War general, that he wanted to run for a third term, and his own party refused to nominate him because there had been so many people, so many railroad bribery scandals in his administration. You know, a good chunk of his cabinet had been busted for being bribed by the railroads. And it got so bad that in 1907, there was a real populist pushback against this in the late 19th century and the early 20th century. And it got so bad that the Republican president, Teddy Roosevelt, in 1907 championed a law called the Tillman Act that made it a felony for a corporation to give money to any candidate for public office at the federal level anyway. They could only make a federal law that made it against the law for corporations to give money to politicians. And that law, that 1907 law, is essentially what was overturned in Citizens United versus FEC.
Let's talk about the Citizens United decision from earlier this year. What does the Supreme Court decision actually say?
Well, I don't have the language in front of me. You have it in the book there. But the essence of it is that it was twofold. One was that corporations have rights under the Constitution because they are persons, and the fact that they are not human beings does not diminish their personness. And, in fact, in his concurring opinion, John Roberts wrote that, the rights of persons should not be isolated to the lonely pamphleteer on the soapbox. In other words, the big corporation should have the protections of the Constitution as well, which is a pretty amazing thing for him to just come right out and say. But the other part of the other rationale that they used was that by limiting... What this was focused on was the McCain-Feingold Act, which, you know, limited the amount of money that could be given to politicians or spent on political campaigns. And really, it's more spent on political campaigns. Arguably, it's still illegal to give money directly to politicians, or there are still limits. But now, any corporation can spend an unlimited amount of money on any campaign as long as they don't coordinate it with the politician or their campaign. And the rationale that was used for that was that the First Amendment, which says that, you know, the right of speech, free speech, shall not be abridged, really also meant, in the minds of the five conservative Supreme Court justices, that our right as citizens to hear speech couldn't be impeded. And so if a giant corporation... Justice Scalia, for example, referred to the large corporations in America as being the most important actors on our economic stage. If their ability to speak to us was inhibited, then our ability to be informed consumers is inhibited, and we suffer. And therefore, there should be no limits on how corporations use their money to involve themselves in political activity.
We're talking to Tom Hartman about his book, Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and How You Can Fight Back. You know, there's a great irony in that when you talk about informed consumers, because that information doesn't have to be true. And as you talk about at some length in the book, corporations have for some time been officially allowed to lie.
Yeah. Well, Mary Charlotte, this is one of the most irony is the perfect word for it, because Nike actually took this all the way to the Supreme Court. It's been there before. If it's legal for you and me to lie, and it is, you know, if a friend says, you know, do I look fat in this shirt or something like that, you could say, right. No, you look great, you know, whether you think so or not. There's nothing wrong with that. It's perfectly legal for us to lie, except in certain circumstances. We can't lie in front of a grand jury. We can't lie if we're under oath. And in most circumstances, it's illegal to lie to a police officer. But generally speaking, we can lie all we want. And so in addition to claiming the right to speak about politics, corporations, and this was asserted in the Citizens United case, corporations also have the right to lie. They have the right to assert what they believe to be their truth, or what they assert is their truth, whether they believe it or not, because there's really no they there with a corporation. A corporation is just a legal construct. It's not a person. So, yeah, it's bizarre.
One of the things which I think is worth saying explicitly, while it's obvious that a corporation is not a person, the ways in which they're different are really important. Human beings are limited by their bodies. They are mortal. They die. They have just inherently in our natures a limited amount of power, whereas corporations can transcend generations. They can grow exponentially and things like that.
Yeah, in fact, as an epigraph in one of the chapter headings, I think I have a quote from William Jennings Bryant of words to that effect. He pointed out that because this was a debate that was going on even back then, that we need clean water to drink, we need fresh air to breathe, we need clean, pure food to eat. Corporations need none of those things. And so when corporations are making decisions, they're not making decisions based on what's best for human beings. They're making decisions based on what's best for the corporation. And to give an entity that is able to amass more power than any individual human, that is able to live forever, that can amass mind-boggling wealth, that can tear off a piece of itself and clone it instantly, that can change its citizenship instantly, or can have multiple citizenship, that can own others of its own kind, to have that kind of an entity with all those incredible superhuman powers have the full rights to level the playing field so that they have the full constitutional rights that you and I, that our founders and generations of Americans fought and died to make sure that you and I have, Mary Charlotte, is insane, frankly.
Yeah. Well, it strikes me as you're talking that limit that a corporation can't go on for more than 40 years is kind of a way that we used to have in the early 19th century, a kind of a way of making them mortal along our own scale.
Right, yeah. In fact, that was explicitly it. And 40 years was only some states. Some states had it 30 years and some states had it at 20 years. So it ran along that spectrum. 20 was the shortest, 40 was the longest. But the idea was that a company or a corporation shouldn't live longer than the productive working life of a human being before it had to do essentially the same thing a human does when they die or when they stop working, which is transfer their wealth to somebody else. And so corporations were fairly rare, and when they were created generally to do projects, like, for example, in the 1840s, I think it was, the Erie Canal Corporation was formed. And it only lasted for the 20 years or so it took to dig the Erie Canal. And that was the kind of thing that the corporate form was typically used for before the railroads came along and just changed everything.
I think it's worth mentioning as an aside that didn't mean that corporations were in any way less exploitive than they have been before or since. I mean, they used labor in horrifyingly exploitive ways, even if they did have limits on them.
Oh, yeah. And then the railroads really pioneered this. I mean, the railroads, Abraham Lincoln was the first president to publicly use the word strike, and he was also the first president to forbid government employees from breaking strikes. Pinkerton and a couple of other private companies came into being in the 19th century explicitly to threaten strikers and in some cases to kill them, to assassinate them. Not necessarily Pinkerton, but that was certainly a very common practice, and the history of labor is full of that kind of thing. And but I think that you could say, back then, at Lincoln's time and before, it wasn't so much corporate bad behavior as it was just rich people's bad behavior. I mean, it's always been, Warren Buffett, yeah, he said, people say there's no class war in America. There certainly is a class war in America, and my class is winning. He was right.
Right. So now that corporations really officially have the right to personhood, you've talked about some of the things that they have that they didn't have before. Do they have any additional duties and responsibilities?
No, but they have some additional rights beyond the right of free speech. They enjoy the First Amendment right of free speech. They assert the Fourth Amendment to privacy, so they don't have to tell us what they're up to. We have to get, you know, search warrants and FOIA filings and all kinds of things. They assert the Fifth Amendment right against taking, and the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, which is how the asbestos companies and the tobacco companies conceal their knowledge that their products are poisonous from us for nearly a half a century, more than half a century. They've asserted the 14th Amendment right against discrimination. You've got giant hog farms and toxic waste operations and even big box stores that have fought local communities trying to keep them out on the 14th Amendment basis that keeping a big box store out of your community is the same as saying to an African American that they can't sit at a lunch counter with a white person. So it is Delphin Delmas is, you know, the guy who argued this 1886 case on behalf of Santa Clara County against the railroads is ludicrous in the extreme, ridiculous in the extreme. It's here. It's happened.
I think it's also important to talk about, I mean, when you talk about the principles, you know, keeping a store out is like keeping a black person from sitting at a lunch counter. That's a principle. People can get behind that. But when you talk about what it actually means, it means in some places that communities are not able to protect what they see as their common good.
That's right. It means that the big box store can come in and put 100 local businesses out of business, wipe out the local individuals in the community, and this is a big box company where every night they push a button and all the money gets vacuumed up and sent off to Little Rock, Arkansas, or whatever, Bentonville, or in the case of McDonald's, off to Chicago, you know, never to be seen again, or only in very small amounts, the small amount that comes back in the form of wages and taxes. And this is not healthy for our community. It's not healthy for America. It's not healthy at a local level. And frankly, you know, the book ends with a very explicit call for action. We need to change the Supreme Court decision. The Supreme Court has become so powerful. It's way more, you know, it has taken onto itself far more power than the framers envisioned. And so the only way to do this is with a constitutional amendment that says, that corrects that mistake in the 14th Amendment, where they forgot to put the word natural before the word person, and says corporations aren't people.
Are there any actual or planned legislative challenges to this Supreme Court decision?
Yeah, and there's a mixed bag of things that are going on. There have been hundreds of communities, actually. The Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDEF.org, CELDEF, has championed many of these, where towns have actually said, in our town, corporations don't have rights under the Constitution. The town of Point Arena was one of the first to pass a resolution of that effect over a decade ago, but these are actual laws that have been passed, and they're being challenged by corporations routinely. There is an attempt to scale back somewhat the impact of the Citizens United case on political campaigns by forcing corporations that fund ads for or against politicians to disclose who they are. And the Supreme Court's case envisioned the possibility of that. And so that's some small solace, I suppose. But on the undoing the corporate personhood part, there are really two efforts at the Constitution that concern me. There's three ways to go about this. One is to pass a constitutional amendment that says that corporations are not persons, and therefore they don't have any rights under the Constitution. That's what I support, and I think makes the most sense, because I think that they're abusing Fourth Amendment rights, Fifth Amendment rights, and 14th Amendment rights as well.
Although, if I may break in just for a moment,
sure.
The likelihood of that in an essentially corporate-bought Congress looks a little dim.
It does, unless the Congress gets really, really frightened. And I think that we may see it. So much abuse in the 2010 election of these corporate basically rights that were given by the Supreme Court that Congress may, when they come back from the 2000 election, the Senate may be willing to do something. We'll see. A lot depends on how many corporate shills end up versus how many frightened, you know, actual Republican and Democratic statesmen and women. One way is to actually just deny corporate personhood. The second is to pass a constitutional amendment that says that corporations don't have First Amendment rights. That's the one that Donna Edwards, has proposed in the House of Representatives and is getting some traction. My concern with that is that it leaves intact all these other corporate rights and that it may be subject to challenge on the grounds that, you know, it's not directly taking on personhood. And then the third, which is being advocated by another progressive group, is that we call a constitutional convention and rewrite the Constitution. And that scares me the most, because that's opening a Pandora's box in this corporate-owned environment that you were just talking about so well, Mary Charlotte, that I think could be really, really dangerous. So I think the way to do it is to simply pass, and there, over at movetoamend.org, there's a sample, very simple constitutional amendment that says basically corporations are not persons under the under this Constitution and do not have the rights of persons under the Bill of Rights.
We're talking to Tom Hartman about his new book, Unequal Protection. So in the case where you have basically law established by the Supreme Court that becomes precedent and becomes the law of the land, and then the Congress passes a law that directly contradicts that, how has that worked out? Who finally has the ultimate say?
Well, that's a great question. In the minds of the founders and the framers of the Constitution, and you can find this back reading the notes, James Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention in 1787, the idea was that the Supreme Court would be the court of last resort, but it would not have the power to overturn laws made by Congress, that because Congress was answerable to the people, because the House of Representatives gets elected every 2 years, every single member, 100% of them, and the Senate every 6 years, although the Senate wasn't elected back then, it was appointed. But because the House of Representatives is elected by the people, that laws that they made that were in error, those errors would be corrected eventually by the people saying, hey, wait a minute, this isn't working, I'm going to hire me a different representative, I'm going to vote for somebody else. They'd throw the bums out. And that was pretty much how it was. The Supreme Court did not have and is not given in the Constitution the right to say that a given law is unconstitutional. And in a case that came before the court in 1803, the third year of Thomas Jefferson's presidency, when the Chief Justice was a fellow by the name of John Marshall, who was Jefferson's first cousin and hated political enemy, and was appointed by John Adams, who was a political opponent of Thomas Jefferson's, as on his way out of town. I mean, Adams was our second president. Jefferson was our third. The election of Jefferson in 1800 is often referred to as the Revolution of 1800, because there were people who thought that Adams was not going to leave office. He was going to refuse to leave office. And ultimately, he did leave office, and Jefferson took over. And Adams' parting shot at Jefferson, the last thing he did was to appoint Jefferson's most potent political foe to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Marshall. And so in 1803, in this case, Marbury versus Madison, John Marshall ruled that the Supreme Court had the right, had the power, to overturn laws made by Congress. And Jefferson went nuts. His letters are reprinted in my book. I think Spencer Roan was the recipient of several of them, who was the uncle of Patrick Henry or the nephew of Patrick Henry. I'm running from memory here, but it's in the book in any case. Jefferson said, if this decision is allowed to stand, then the Constitution itself has become a felo de se, which is Latin for a suicide pact. He said, the Constitution, if this isn't changed, the Constitution now has become a thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary. And he was very upset, and he worked very hard to try and get it overturned, but was unsuccessful. Congress would not take action. There were a lot of Federalists in the Congress in 1803, 1804. John Marshall was a big-time Federalist. That was kind of the Republicans of that day. Jefferson was the founder of what is today's Democratic Party. They were called the Democratic Republicans at the time. And so we've had, ever since 1803, a Supreme Court that has taken onto itself the power to neutralize, to eliminate, to just strike off the books laws made by Congress, and therefore the Supreme Court is the most powerful institution in the United States government. I mean, the Supreme Court is so powerful that they could declare that child labor laws are unconstitutional, and there would be no child labor laws. you could, you know, 10-year-olds could be forced to go to work. And in fact, they did declare that in as I recall, 1914. It might have been 1917. They declared that minimum wage laws were unconstitutional around that same time. On the other hand, Congress could declare that under the General Welfare Clause, the Supreme Court could declare that, in their opinion, under the General Welfare Clause, that health care is a right, not a privilege, and therefore we have to have single-payer health care. And literally the next day we would have to have single-payer health care, you know, Medicare for all. That's how much power the Supreme Court has, and that's why the focus of conservatives over the last 30 years with the Federalist Society and virtually, you know, this laser-like focus on the presidency has been to make sure that they can get the most conservative, corporate-friendly people on the Supreme Court possible. They talk about abortion and things like that. That's not what they care about. John Roberts was there to represent, and Sam Alito are there to represent the interests of multinational corporations, and they do a very good job of that.
I think it's also worth pointing out that the strides that progressive movements have made in things like rights for African Americans and women's suffrage and gay rights and things like that are things that really don't negatively affect corporate bottom lines.
Generally not, no, although they've very often been fought by corporations. I think it's particularly ironic, you know, for example, in one of the cases I talk about in the book, as I recall, it was Dow Chemical. A whistleblower contacted the EPA. This was in the late 70s after the EPA was formed, and gave them evidence that a chemical factory was emitting into the air illegally carcinogenic waste. And so the EPA hired a private pilot in a small plane. They flew over the top of the factory, and they took the picture, and, you know, they had proof. And they sued, and they fined the company. And the company fought that all the way to the Supreme Court, claiming that their Fourth Amendment right of privacy had been invaded by the private plane flying over the top of the factory. And what's so ironic is that if you worked in that factory, as soon as you walk in the door, you surrender your First Amendment right of free speech. You could be fired for anything you say. You surrender your Fourth Amendment right to privacy. They can monitor you with video cameras. They can listen in on your phone conversations. They can read your emails. They can even demand bodily fluids from you and examine them however they want. You surrender your Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. They can ask you questions, and if you refuse to answer them correctly, you can be fired. You basically lose all your rights, and yet the corporation is keeping all those rights intact for itself 24/7. It's bizarre.
Let's talk for a moment. I mean, this whole conversation really is about this, but the inherent tension between corporate power and democracy. When a corporation becomes a person, which is so, what do we have now? Can a corporation then register to vote?
Well, they can do the functional equivalent, which is influence the outcome of an election. And that's, you know, that's why this shouldn't be.
Well, and so that's the thing, is when you have corporations with a huge amount of power that are essentially influencing the outcomes of elections, then democracy is so very compromised, and you can barely call it democracy anymore.
Yeah, well, that's the argument that many of us are making and that I make in the book. There is a corporation called Murray Hill Incorporated, that is running for Congress right now, murrayhillforcongress.com. And, you know, it's some anti-corporate power activists who are doing this tongue-in-cheek, but they've actually filed the forms and things, and they're asserting that as a person they should have the right to be elected to Congress. And you can see, you know, they've got a campaign website and everything. So it's like, how far are we going to take this thing? It is crazy.
We're talking to Tom Hartman about his book, Unequal Protection. So the subtitle of the book is How Corporations Became People and How You Can Fight Back. Let's talk about that. How can people fight back?
Well, there are some legislative efforts, we mentioned them, but I really think that because the Supreme Court has taken this mind-boggling amount of power onto itself since 1803, that there are really only two solutions. One is the one that happened for Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s. Now, in the 1920s, the Supreme Court had ruled that many of the progressive laws that were passed during the Teddy Roosevelt administration, minimum wage laws, maximum work hours, the 50-hour week, the six-day week, maximum number of days that you can work, child labor laws, that all those things were unconstitutional. They all got ripped down in the 19-teens. And several of Franklin Roosevelt's initial efforts to make progressive movements and to legalize unions and things like that in the early 30s were shot down by the Supreme Court. And at one point, he even tried to pack the court, because the Constitution doesn't say that there shall only be nine justices on the court. So since Franklin Roosevelt was being stymied by the court, he said, okay, well, let's just increase the size of the court to 12, and I'll put my own three guys on there, and we'll have a majority again. And that blew up in his face. Americans thought that was a bridge too far. But ultimately, in 1936, as I recall, a justice died or retired, and Roosevelt got a friendly majority on the court. And pretty much ever since then, the court has been allowing things like minimum wage laws. So there are five conservative justices on the court right now who believe that corporations should have the same rights as persons. And Kennedy is probably the oldest. Scalia is in his 70s. If one of those five members, were to retire or leave the bench for whatever reason, if there is a Democrat in the White House, then it would be possible to change the composition of the court in a way that the court itself could then reverse Citizens United. And this has happened. I mean, in 1854, the Supreme Court in the Dred Scott versus Sanford decision ruled that people are property. This was the case where they said that African Americans' slaves were the property of white people, and it led right to the Civil War. The mirror image of that ruling is the 2010 Citizens United decision, where the court ruled that property are persons. And the Supreme Court has overruled itself on numerous occasions. It reversed Dred Scott. It reversed in 1954 with the Brown versus Board of Education case. It was essentially reversed in the 1889 case, Plessy versus Ferguson, in 1973 with the legalization of abortion, Roe v. Wade. It was essentially reversing a 1963 or 4 case, the name of which I can't remember, Griswold versus Connecticut, and a few others. It's not impossible that if the court's makeup changed, that it could simply reverse itself. That's one thing. And one of the reasons why many of us think it's so important to make sure that there's a Democrat in the White House in 2012 in that election, because probably those conservatives, at least one or two of them, are going to retire or whatever, maybe 6-8 years from now. The other way is to pass a constitutional amendment. And that is to say to the Supreme Court, okay, we don't care what you say the Constitution says, we're going to write this right into the Constitution. Now, there have been over 29,000 constitutional amendments proposed since the Constitution was first ratified in 1789. And of those 29,000, only, I think 28 or 29 have actually made it into law. It has to pass two-thirds of the Senate, and it has to be ratified by three-quarters of the states. So it's a pretty high bar. It's pretty tough to make happen. On the other hand, very often it takes years. On the other hand, sometimes it's really, really fast. In 73, I don't have the book in front of me, but my recollection, the Vietnam War was going on, and people, there was that song, Age of Destruction, where there was the line, you're old enough to kill but not for voting. And young people were furious. And everybody had this sense that it was just really, really unfair that we had a draft and that, 50,000 young people had died in the Vietnam War, and they didn't even have the right to vote on that war. And so in less than 6 months, the constitutional amendment to lower the voting age from 21 to 18 passed the Senate and then was ratified by three-quarters of the states. So it's happened before. And I think that if there's enough popular outrage, it could happen again.
When we think about popular outrage, and I think probably, at least here in Santa Fe, many of our listeners deeply understand what you're talking about and the dangers of this. At the same time, I guess when you think about your own life, how you live, how I live, our lives are so bound up in corporations and the stuff that they provide us. And some people say, well, we're addicted to all this stuff we don't need and so on. But it's just as valid and important and honest to say that we have all of these things that are produced not locally, that are produced by big, huge national corporations because we feel that they improve our lives, like cell phones and computers and stuff, you know, things in the drugstore and cars and, you know, 24/7 electricity. It just goes on and on and on. And on top of that, many, many middle-class people have their retirement bound up in corporate investments of one kind or another. So it's tricky intellectually and emotionally to take an us versus them attitude.
You're right, Mary Charlotte. And there's, and in that regard, there's a whole nother path that I think as Americans we should be having a dialogue about and we should consider. My wife Louise and I last summer were in Mondragon, Spain, which is a little town in the Basque region of Spain. Mondragon means Mountain of the Dragon. There was a particularly brutal prince who ruled that area in the 17th century, or in the 15th century rather, and it was named after him. And in this area that had seen the horrors of this very brutal man, a company was started called the Mondragon Cooperative, and it now, if my memory serves me right, does over $17 billion a year in business and has over 40,000 employees around the world. And I might even be understating that. You can certainly Google them and find their Wikipedia entry and everything. And they're doing business in dozens of countries. And the most highly paid person in the company, who we met, the president, makes three times what the most lowly paid person in the company makes. All of the decisions are made from the bottom up, and all of the stock is owned by the employees, and it works. Louise and I visited an assembly line in a washing machine manufacturing facility in Mondragon, owned by the cooperative, and we had a translator with us because they were all speaking Basque, and there was a group of about six people on this assembly line where they were assembling the electronic circuit boards and the front panel for the washing machines. And a manager came over, you know, a guy in a suit, and they were all wearing their kind of white, keep everything clean uniforms. And he came over, and he started talking to them, and our translator said, okay, he said that on Thursday they're going to change some item on the product, and so the assembly line has to be reconfigured. And then there was this long conversation between them and the manager, and this translator said they're discussing the topic. And Louise and I assumed that the manager was telling them how it was going to be done. And then when there's an obvious consensus has been reached and the manager writes something down in his pad and everybody says, okay, and he walks off and a translator turns to us and says, the workers have agreed on how they're going to make the change. They've informed the manager and he's going to go back and inform his management how the change will be implemented. Like, what? The universe just turned upside down.
Right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but that I think we're left with an important contemplation about equality, not only between human beings and corporations, but really among each other. But we'll have to leave that for the next conversation because this is it. Tom Hartman is the author of Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and How You Can Fight Back. He's a syndicated talk show host on many radio stations. He's also on Free Speech TV. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Brian Highhill for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz presents a jazz suite by British jazz star Guy Barker. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we will see you tomorrow. Adios.